El siguiente es un programa pagado por el anunciante y 1600 AM no se hace responsable por las opiniones reflejadas en su contenido.
This is a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM, so please stay tuned.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Demirgerdic, and my guest today is Dr. David Gutman, who is from Manhattanville College in New York. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on, Barlow.
You've recently written a book about Armenian migration from Ottoman Turkey to the United States in the period of 1885 to 1915. So tell us a little bit about the overall picture of the book. What is it about? And then we'll talk more about it as well.
All right, great. Yeah. So the book is really a study of, as the title suggests, the politics of migration. So rather than looking at a story of, for example, people coming to the United States, places like Worcester or Fresno, settling down, sort of incorporating into the community, instead, what it's focusing on is actually how people moved out of Ottoman Armenia to the coast of the Ottoman Empire, onto ships, how they got across the Atlantic to the United States, but it also focuses on return migration. So people in the pre-genocide period who ended up returning after, say, 5-10 years in the United States. And what it's really focusing on is both the Ottoman state's response to this migration. The Ottoman Empire viewed specifically Armenian migration as a political threat, and especially return migration as a political threat. This is in the context, of course, of the emergence of political organizations like the Hunchakyan Revolutionary Party and the Dashnak Tsutsiun. And from the perspective of the Ottoman state, migration to North America was one and the same as the emergence of these political organizations. So in the minds of the Ottoman state, what I see almost as a sense of paranoia, and it's the kind of paranoia we often see both governments and societies have in response to groups that are on the move. The Ottoman state viewed this Armenian migration as linked to the emergence of these political organizations, and so therefore sought both to prevent Armenians from leaving the empire and to prevent those who did leave from returning. And so it looks at, again, how people moved in response to this ban, the smuggling networks that emerged to help Armenian migrants get to the coast and then onto ships headed for the United States, and then also how both the Ottoman state and the U.S. government especially dealt with those who returned, and in particular those who had naturalized as American citizens. So it's looking at the politics of migration in the context of this migration ban.
And in the period between, let's say, the 19th century was an important period in Armenian immigration history, because I think according to Robert Myrack's book, between 1830 or 1890, there wasn't more than maybe 1,500 Armenians mm-hmm. who ever actually left Turkey. And then it was really in the 1880s that this movement really accelerated. What was your findings? That parallel to that?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I use his numbers. He estimates about 75 to 80,000 Armenians come to primarily the United States, to a much lesser degree to Canada, in this period, roughly late 1880s to the genocide, to 1915. And what drives that sudden spike in the late 1880s is a combination of factors. Of course, you've had the missionaries in places like Harpert for several decades up to that point that are sort of providing a network of information about the possibilities that exist in the United States. And so it's no surprise that many of the first Armenians end up in places like Worcester and Fitchburg and Lynn and Providence, because, of course, this is where the ABCFM, the major missionary organization, was located. But also, of course, you have the arrival of steamships to secondary ports in the Ottoman Empire, like Samsun on the Black Sea, Mersin on the Mediterranean, and that significantly lowers the price of passage. And I see, first and foremost, Armenian migration to North America emerging in the late 1880s is building off of prior patterns of regional migration. So the Panduks, for example, who would go to Istanbul or Adana or to Aleppo in the middle to later part of the 19th century, with the idea of working in these places for a few years and then returning home, sending money, this kind of thing, that migration to North America is a version of this, but just on a much larger both time scale and space scale.
So it was probably the intent of those first immigrants to return, right, to the return to Ottoman Turkey.
Right, exactly. I mean, the idea here is we're going to go 5, maybe 10 years, make some money, return, maybe buy a plot of land, maybe start a family. And that did happen. Even after the Hamidian massacres, there are still large numbers of people who are returning. I estimate somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 20% of those who migrated to the United States eventually returned. It's very difficult to tell who returns permanently, who returns temporarily. So much of this return is probably on a temporary basis. People want to get married, people who want to look after elderly parents, people who want to, are homesick and want to visit home. And maybe, they return for a couple of years and then they go back to the United States. I think that was a very common phenomenon.
Right. What about the records for this? So where do you find the primary records for this type of immigration or migration?
Right. So the vast majority of my source base, they really come from two sources. One are the Ottoman State Archives and the other are the American Consular Reports. I also use Armenian sources in translation, since unfortunately my reading Armenian isn't up to snuff enough to be able to use those documents in a real consistent manner. But the Ottoman state sources, I think, are the richest for telling this story again of how states responded to this mobility. And it was through those sources that allowed me to retrace these smuggling networks that emerged to help people mm-hmm. out of the empire and then in many cases back into the empire when they were returning, to be able to see all the nodes along the point. The Ottoman state was very interested in this because it was concerned about Armenian migration, and so kept meticulous records about, which officials are involved in assisting migration. Agents or boatmen who were arrested either in the port cities or in the interior while they were smuggling migrants. So this allowed to be able to develop, to recreate how these networks worked and how people essentially got around this migration ban.
So the population of Armenians probably in the late 19th century was somewhere over 2 million mm-hmm. by most estimates. Mm-hmm. So how do you estimate in terms of the percentage then that we're trying to migrate? How many do you estimate we're trying to get out? Or
so in terms of so there's a real regional dynamic to this migration. Of course, Armenians are migrating from throughout historic Armenia. But the vast majority in this period before the genocide, and especially before the 1908 Young Turk Revolution, when, again, most Armenians who are leaving have to rely on these smuggling networks, the vast majority are coming from within 50 or 60 kilometers of Kharpert. And so places like Palu, Keri, Husseini, this is where the majority of this migration is coming from. So even though 75,000 to 80,000 may be relatively small percentage-wise compared to the entire Armenian population of the empire, when you get down to these individual communities in the Kharpert region that are responsible for most of this migration, you get percentages in these communities easily of 30-40% of the young male population would be living abroad at any one point. And you see this reflected in the village histories and in the memoirs that have been published since about how significant this was to some of these communities, in which, again, many of the young male population would be gone for any stretch of any given time in that window.
Well, what was the dynamic of that? Why was Skarpert the sort of epicenter of the migration? Was it because it was easier to go somewhere from there, or the government wasn't paying as much attention? Or?
So I think it's a combination of factors. Again, of course, you have a huge missionary presence with the Euphrates College in Skarpert, which I think really helps to that initial wave even before the mid-1880s, when you have people going abroad studying at places like Yale or in divinity schools in the United States that sort of offer the first link to the U.S. beginning as early as the 1860s and 1870s. But it's Skarpert, like other communities in historic Armenia, again, had a pretty established tradition of regional labor migration. But I think one key difference is that, and again, here speaking on a comparative basis, the Skarpert region is more politically and economically integrated into the Ottoman system in this period, say, compared to Mush or Bitlis or even Van. And the Armenian community there is somewhat more economically prosperous than their counterparts, especially further east. And migration's a risk. Long-distance migration is a risk. It's extremely costly, especially when you're having to go through these smuggling networks. And so these documents allow me to estimate how much it cost to migrate. And usually it's anywhere between about 15 or 20 Ottoman lira, which is connected to the British pound. And if you adjust that for inflation into the 21st century, you're talking about the equivalent of $10,000-$15,000 to migrate through these clandestine channels. So it's a significant sum of money. Right. And so to do so requires some degree of means and at least the sense that essentially migration is going to pay off, that you're going to get that job in the States, that you're going to be able to remit money back, that you know, you'll may be able to save enough money back to return.
So let's take an individual, like take the example of an individual from Skarpert. So what would be the process that they would have to do to be able to migrate? What did they have to overcome in terms of the challenges, the laws, and how did that happen?
Right.
Just like the real mechanics of it.
So for example, there are these people that stick out very much in the documentary material, what I call migration agents. These are essentially kingpin smugglers in these communities that have access to or connected to these wide networks of guides, muleteers, boatmen, hoteliers in these different port cities that are responsible for seeing people from the interior to the coast and then getting them on ships, getting their travel arranged. It's hard to tell exactly how these migration agents, you know, whether people came to them or whether they went to people like recruiters. I think it's more likely that a person desiring to migrate would approach one of these people or an agent of one of these people and say, look, I want to, you know, looking to head abroad. And then there would be a, I think, pretty formalized process of either contracting, so you could take loans. Like, for example, one prominent migration agent was perhaps the most prominent banker in the Skarpert region in the first decade of the 20th century. His name was Artin Harputlian, and he had a whole method of financing these migration trips. So people would take out loans with his bank. He had a brother living on the east coast of the United States who seemed to be responsible for collecting on migrant debts. And there was a whole channel that helped funnel this money back to Artin Harputlian's bank in the Skarpert region. And so, again, you're talking about a very, very coordinated network that, a migrant who's looking to leave would approach. And then that person would leave with a large caravan, maybe 10, 15, 20 people who are migrating just like he is. And they would end up at any number of port cities, Samsun on the Black Sea, Mersin, on the Mediterranean. Some end up as far as Latakia or Beirut along the eastern Mediterranean. Often they'd have to wait a couple weeks to a couple months at port while their travel is being arranged. Mm-hmm. And then boatmen would, under the cover of night, row them out to these waiting ships. They would be hoisted onto these ships, again, under the cover of darkness to avoid Ottoman authorities who could stop them if they saw them. And then headed off on the trip to a European transit port and then on to the United States.
Would these networks be primarily Armenians or Turks, or were they mixed?
It's mixed. So, for example, I mean, this was common. Artin Harputlian obviously is himself of Armenian background, but the muleteer guides would often be Kurdish guides leading people from the interior to the coast. And then once they're in port cities, oftentimes the, you know, people that they're staying with in these hotels or boarding rooms would be Armenian natives of their home communities, oftentimes. But they would then be linked to a very diverse group of people in these port cities: police officers, foreign steamship ticketing agents, and the boatmen. Any of these could be coming from a wide variety of backgrounds, so not just Armenian. These are very diverse networks.
So the first sort of generation of migrants were predominantly male, single males,
right,
or maybe married, but
uh-huh,
predominantly single. When did women and children start to get into that migration pattern? And then it must have been very difficult, more difficult, I would think, for a woman or for a child to actually migrate.
Right, exactly. So after the Hamidian massacres, the Ottoman state opens up a legal channel for migration. So you have the essentially unlawful, the undocumented route, which most young Armenian men would have gone through rather than try to seek legal permission. This legal route, which was introduced in 1896, and it reflects the kind of, again, paranoia and fears that the Ottoman state has about Armenian migration. The Ottoman state will give you, and this is often directed toward women and dependent children of migrants who are already abroad, permission to leave, to go to the United States, but you have to promise to cut off all connections with your home community, you have to forswear your Ottoman nationality, and you have to promise never to return. And so here again, the idea here is that you're cutting the cord completely. Mm. And the Ottoman state then feels comfortable giving permission, because the idea is that once you're gone, you can't come back. And this became a major route for the spouses, dependent children of migrants already living in the United States to come across without having to travel through these smuggling networks, because, again, they would have had paperwork provided for them by the Ottoman state. But, again, it comes with these draconian conditions that prevent, or at least seek to prevent, return. And in fact, by the first decade of the 20th century, the Ottoman state has this down to a kind of system where they take photographs of those who are leaving through this legal channel. And a colleague of mine named Zeynep Gürsel, who's in the anthropology department at Rutgers, mm-hmm, is doing a project actually looking at these photographs of Armenian migrants who had been given legal permission. Mm-hmm. And the idea behind these photographs is they'd be kept at these various port cities, and if you tried to return, they'd have photographic evidence. They would try to match it with your face, and if you were a familiar person, then the Ottoman state could debar you at port, essentially prevent you from being able to enter.
That was my next question. So how many people were they able to bar literally coming back? I mean, was that common for them to be able to recognize and to figure out who had left illegally and
right, so
trying to come back?
So again, so my book focuses primarily on that unlawful channel. And so this becomes a problem, because Armenian migrants who seek to return, they know that the Ottoman state is going to try to prevent them from returning. So again, you know, when migrants and people on the move find impediments and obstacles in their path, they devise ways to get around those impediments and obstacles. And of course, those who want to return, those who want to visit their family, those who want to see elderly parents, who want to visit the houses in which they're born, you know, they're not going to let the Ottoman, mm-hmm, state serve as a, mm-hmm, as an obstacle. And so they find ways, they find strategies to return, again, to bypass this ban on return migration. Again, these are people who left unlawfully, not who left through the legal stream. Right. If so, many do succeed then through these clandestine channels to return home. But this then creates a new problem, which is that, especially beginning in 1905, after the ARF attempts to assassinate Sultan Abdulhamid II, this paranoia ratchets up, and Ottoman officials in Mamuretul Aziz, which is the province in which Kharpert is, begin essentially instituting a policy of deporting Armenians who have been determined to have returned from unlawful sojourns in North America. And so there are all of these reports of people being arrested, being detained, and then being led under armed guard to the coast, to Samsun, and forcefully put on ships sailing out of the empire. Mm-hmm. So there was a distinct danger, even if you succeeded in returning, of being captured by state officials and deported in this fashion.
Now, were there other minority groups within the Ottoman Empire that were migrating at a similar pace, or was it basically Armenians in this period?
No, so other communities are also migrating. Of course, famously, you have large populations of Lebanese and Syrians from the Levant, who are leaving at the same time, in numbers much greater than that of Armenians. You know, I think the estimate is several hundred thousand who leave roughly in the same period, the 1880s up until the start of World War One, and the same kinds of dynamics are at play: relatively large scale return migration, either on a temporary or permanent basis. Ottoman Jews are migrating in some numbers. Assyrians, Muslims. And we have to remember that the Ottoman state, first and foremost, classifies people along sectarian lines, along religious lines, rather than ethnic lines. So they would use the term Muslim. We don't know if they were Kurds, mm-hmm. Turks. Mm-hmm. But you have large numbers of Assyrians, large numbers of Turkish and Kurdish Muslims who are also leaving from the Kharpet region at the same time. The Ottoman state views Armenian migration specifically as a threat. And so it treats the Armenian migrant differently than these other groups. And again, it's a reflection of the fact that the Ottoman state has this, again, this almost paranoia about what Armenian migration means. And so, for example, I was mentioning this practice of deporting people who had returned. It's not also legal for Muslims or Assyrians to leave without permission. And so you have people who have left also through these same smuggling networks, Muslims and Assyrians, who also return. But the Ottoman state makes clear that Assyrians and Muslims are allowed to be, they can re-enter. They have to pay a small fine as a punishment for unlawful migration, but they don't face deportation. They don't face the same treatment that Armenians face. So this is a very specific Armenian phenomenon.
My guest today is Dr. David Gutman from Manhattanville College, and he's just written a book about migration to the United States from the Ottoman Empire, Armenian Migration. And when we come back from our break, we'll continue our discussion with him.
Oh,
Tune in to All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Dermagerdichian with the Armenian Studies Program. My guest today is Dr. David Gutman, who's here in the studio from Manhattanville College in New York. Welcome, Dr. Gutman. David.
Thank you.
We were talking about Armenian migration from the Ottoman Empire to the United States, but I want to talk a little bit about how you got interested, because that's got to be an interesting way that how did you get to come to this topic to study?
Right. So basically, my interest in Ottoman history, in Armenians in the Ottoman Empire, grew out of an interest I had as an undergraduate now almost 15 years ago, or more than 15 years ago, in the Armenian genocide. I took a course on genocide, again, you know, 15, 20 years ago, and I of course, knew a fair amount about the Holocaust, had been interested in that since childhood, and wanted to do something different, wanted to find out about a different historic episode of genocide. And so ended up writing a final paper on the Armenian genocide. And while I was there at the University of Minnesota, this corresponded with Professor Taner Akçam being there. So I met him, and in my discussions with him, got very interested in the kind of Ottoman, the historical context in the Ottoman Empire that gave rise to the Armenian genocide. And I ended up studying in Turkey for a while, came back, applied for graduate school, got accepted, studied at SUNY Binghamton, and thought that I would be moving in a different direction, still studying some aspect of Ottoman history. But then I was at the U.S. Archives looking at these consular reports that were talking about people coming back and forth, and I thought that was really fascinating. It was surprising to me, not so much that people were leaving, but that people were coming back, and this was gaining the notice of U.S. consular officials. And then when I was in Turkey and doing my doctoral research in Turkey and coming across all of these documents about smuggling, about issues of, you know, how to deal with Armenian migrants who had naturalized as U.S. citizens, I thought there's a really interesting and fascinating story here. And as I was writing the book, this corresponded with the sudden interest over the past few years in migration on the Mediterranean. And of course, clandestine migration networks are a central part of that story in the present day. And so I think that as the project has evolved, the work that I'm doing feels more and more relevant as, you know, the experiences that I see Armenian migrants having gone through 100, 120 years ago are similar to the ones that we see migrants experiencing today as states try to frustrate their ability to move and they are forced to go through these clandestine channels and they're considered a threat and conjured as a threat by states. And I think that that's a significant story that the Armenian experience helps to shed light on.
And so you've had the opportunity to travel to the places that you've been studying, correct?
Right.
So tell us a little bit about some of those travels. Where have you been in old Armenia or Turkey?
Uh-huh.
Where have you visited? And
so I've spent, obviously, considerable amounts of time in Istanbul and Ankara, but I've also traveled to Urfa, to Diyarbakir, to Van, to Doğubayazıt. So much of what's now, you know, southeastern Turkey. Mm-hmm. I didn't, unfortunately, make it to Elazığ, which is the modern-day name for Karpert, but you know, many of the cities that I visited in the East are very similar and had very similar kinds of dynamics. So thankfully, I've gotten the opportunity to travel pretty extensively and see at least, you know, historic Armenia and these places as these migrants I discuss would have seen them 100, 120 years.
You talked about migration. We were talking about the period between 1885 and 1915, but of course there was the Ottoman Revolution in 1908. So mm-hmm. How did that change this whole dynamic of migration?
So it changed at a very fundamental level, and I think that when people have read the book or have heard me speak on the book, it's surprising that an event like a revolution, although of course it's meant to be dramatic, very rapid change, can change a dynamic so quickly. So when the constitutional government takes power in July 1908. They lift the bans on migration. So not just on the specific bans that are placed on Armenian migration, but also the ones that apply to other groups within the Ottoman Empire also. So that allowed people to leave freely and also return freely. And as a result, you see a significant expansion of the geography of migration. So you see more people leaving from places like Van and Bitlis, Sivas, than had been the case before, because they don't have to go through these channels anymore. And also you get a significant spike in return migration, as now it's safer, or people think it's safer, to return in the context of the collapse of the Hamidian regime. And this is the case even after the massacres in Adana in 1909. So that the highest rate of return, and this is coming from U.S. sources, the highest rate of Armenian return migration is in 1914. And so it gives you an idea that, of course, people are returning thinking that the political situation is safer, when in fact, when the war descends, it's not the case at all.
And so the government at the time, the Young Turks, simply just didn't see any more threat from the Armenians, and that's why they lifted this migration obstacles, because they just felt it's okay, it's all right to do that?
Well, so there's a fascinating tension, because, of course, we know that the Committee of Union and Progress is a very, you know, it's a nationalist organization, effectively an Ottoman nationalist organization, one that becomes increasingly authoritarian in its behavior, increasingly chauvinistically pro-Turkish, and takes on that sort of Turkish nationalist identity approaching World War I. But at the same time, the constitutional revolution, it's not just dominated by the CUP. There are, in fact, a number of different political organizations. The ARF, the Dashnak Tsutsuyun, is a member, is a part of the new constitutional regime. And there really is a commitment on some parts. There's this idea that constitutional rule means a turn toward liberal governance. And an enlightened liberal regime, and here I mean liberal in the classical sense, doesn't have restrictions on mobility. It doesn't limit people's ability to move across borders. That's a holdover in the thinking that underpins this move of a despotic society, and that's what we're trying to move away from. We're trying to move away from the despotism of the Hamidian era. Now, as we come to, say, 1910, 1911, 1912, increasingly the concern is not about Armenian migration per se, but rather that people are leaving from all over the empire in high numbers. They're avoiding military service, because now after 1909, military service is compulsory for all Ottoman citizens, regardless of their religious background. So you have large numbers of people as the Balkan Wars emerge in 1912, 1913. You have the war in Italy, against Italy and Libya in 1911. The Ottoman state desperately needs military-age men to serve. And so there does emerge in, say, 1911, 1912, 1913, at least an effort to start cracking down on some way on people's ability to leave. But it is met with also resistance from some quarters within the Ottoman state that say, no, we can't do this because we are a liberal constitutional regime. We can't restrict people's mobility. We have to find other strategies to prevent people from leaving. But never again, up until World War I, is, at least in the official discourse of the Ottoman state, in these documents that are circulating between the provinces and the capital, is specifically Armenian migration seen as a threat.
And in many of the places where they were leaving, I mean, many places simply became deserted, is that right? I mean, like many villages and towns would have so many people leaving that they would, in a sense, become deserted, or...
I don't think that's actually the case so much that, I mean, again, so you have these communities that will have 30, 40% of their young male population gone, but again, you know, their families in many cases will still be there, wives, young children, elderly parents. And so, because again, even up until 1914, 1915, the idea is we're going to go abroad, work for a while, maybe return, or maybe send money back so families can join us in the United States. So still, you know, there are large numbers of people who are in these places that then, when the war starts and the deportation order is made in 1915 and the genocide begins, it becomes much harder for people to leave and to escape.
Did you do some sort of economic analysis? In other words, you said it was pretty expensive, maybe $10,000 to $15,000 in today's money. But how long would they have to work in the United States before they would be able to afford to come back?
That's a good question. I think that's an open question that I wasn't able to, in a really satisfactory way, answer. Mm-hmm. But I think that what I hope happens with the book, of course, Robert Myrack's book, which still is the kind of crowning achievement of work on this topic now, is almost 40 years old. Right. And I think, you know, my book helps to tell a very particular angle of the story, but there are so many aspects of this migration story that are left unanswered that I'm hoping that people will start to take on the challenge of reading Armenian newspapers, for example, in the United States, as we were talking about yesterday, mm-hmm. or even reading the Armenian newspapers that are being printed in the Ottoman Empire too. I think those are fabulous stories that are left to be told. The Hushamadyan, the memoirs, many of which remain untranslated from Armenian to English, to work in those, I think, would help to shed light on various aspects of this story that still are left uncovered.
Are you still continuing then to work on this topic, or is this something you put aside, or are you finished, or you still want to go and study some more in those areas?
So I'm still trying to figure out a new direction. So the book came out now about 7-8 months ago, and I'm still trying to figure out what direction I'm to turn on my next project. So it'll probably be something different than migration. I feel like I've made my mm-hmm. my mark, my contribution there. And would maybe like to branch out into a couple of other directions, but I'm still giving that some thought.
But outside the Armenian migration
Probably outside the question of migration, but yeah. I think would still touch on aspects of the Armenian experience in the mm-hmm. Ottoman Empire.
But if you were suggesting to people areas that could still be studied, what areas in that period would you say, like the ones that you still didn't get to quite in migration?
In migration, yeah. So like you mentioned, I mean, I think that there's a lot more work to be done on the Armenian experience in North America. I think that there's a lot of work to be done on what I would love to see is a study of how migration dollars, in a sense, money that's being remitted back to the Harpert region, or money that people who return with and are investing in land, is that dramatically changing the kind of socioeconomic environments in the Harpert region? Is it what effect is it having on local and regional politics? I mean, I have, and I mentioned this and discussed some of these issues in the book, but I feel like not in a way that can really shed light on how does migration really transform mm-hmm. The direction of the Harpert region? Because what I see, and this is what I end the book with, is the genocide is such a moment of unrivaled destruction. And the Harpert region, its Armenian past is within a couple of decades almost entirely erased. Mm-hmm. And the city that's there now, Elaz, is a relatively conservative provincial city in Turkey. But I often think, what if the genocide hadn't happened? And what direction was that region on? And I see it as one in which the Armenian community of the Harpert region was becoming more economically and politically ascendant. And so a question that I often raises in my mind, is that a reason why, for example, the Harpert region is such a site of destruction during the genocide in a way that, you know, of course, you have organized resistance in Van that doesn't take place to the same degree as the Harpert region. But, I mean, the level of destruction, of death, is so great in the Harpert region. I often wonder if that's a response to the emergence of a relatively prosperous and politically powerful Armenian society there that's in part fueled by this migration.
Now, when you were doing your research, you said you were working in the Ottoman archives, but then there are works by Armenians that would also cover the same issue, right? Memoirs or other uh-huh. things. Did you get a chance to incorporate some of those?
Yes, I did. So, for example, there's this wonderful village history of the village of Parchanj, which is one of these villages that's very close to Harpert, within 10 kilometers, mm-hmm. That also had high rates of migration. It's written by it was written by Manoug Zeron in the 1930s, and it provides some of this insight into how migration is transforming the local socioeconomic and political environment there. There's this wonderful book that's in translation. It's the translated letters of a Keretzi migrant named Israel Safarian, who so his letters back to his family, actually his letters from his family to him, and then letters also from him to his family in Kennedy before the genocide. It also has a 20-page sort of memoir story about how he left Kerry and migrated through Batumi, which was then under the control of the Russian Empire, that shed some wonderful light on the experience of migration itself, who he stayed with when he was in Batumi, who was a Keretsi, who was living in Batumi and had a boarding house, how guides led them across the mountains and across the Russian frontier. So again, and you know, this is the stuff that has been translated, which begs the question, I mean, what remains in what remains untranslated, what remains in people's basements, and you know, the stories written down by grandparents, great grandparents now who went through this experience of migration in the pre-genocide period.
Did you follow that migration to the United States, and so you can tell where these migrants ended up in the United States? Is that something you followed?
Yeah, to some degree. And the Kharpertsi migrants are, for the most part, ending up in the Northeast. And of course, this remains the case today, that the communities in places like Boston, Worcester, many of them are the descendants of these Kharpertsi migrants that came in the pre-1915 period. Of course, people are also coming to the West Coast in some numbers too, but it seems to me, and again, this is another aspect that remains open for I think much more scholarly probing, is who does end up where and why. So is it that the kind of unique sort of economic labor migration aspect of migration from the Carpet region in this period, is this why so many are ending up in places like Fitchburg and Lynn and Worcester? And who is it that makes a decision to come to a place like Fresno and instead buy land rather than working in a factory? I think those are very, very interesting stories, and it would be interesting to probe how that links to maybe dynamics that are at play in places like Merzifon, Carpet, Diyarbakir in the late 19th, early 20th
centuries. So they would come here and they would form these ethnic enclaves by almost village or town, right? I mean, they
right.
lived together in sort of small reproductions, if you will, of the old country.
Right, absolutely. So, and again, that also is a reflection, that's not by accident, it's a reflection also of these networks that exist. That's how these smuggling networks survive, is through these community networks that link these various places along the chain of migration.
You think those networks still exist? I mean, they existed after World War I? I mean, is that something that still is always there in terms of migration?
I mean, absolutely. So, you know, of course, the networks themselves, who peoples these networks, who's responsible for them, that changes over time. But smuggling remains a central way in which both people and goods are moved in the post-Ottoman world. So, yes, in some form, these smuggling networks do survive. And in fact, I was listening the other day to the Columbia University has made available a number of these testimonies of genocide survivors. And I was listening to one of a man who was born in 1909 in Boston. So he was born an American citizen, but he and his family returned to Kharpert in 1912, 1913. And he was able to survive in part because he was a native-born citizen of the U.S. And Leslie Davis, the famous consul in Harput at the time, took him in and offered him protection, he and his family protection. But he talks about being in the Kharpert region after the genocide, and there's still some survivors who return. And eventually, by the early 1920s, a number of Armenians are seeking to get out, and they're finding these same kind of limits on their mobility in place by the Republic of Turkey, probably just seeking to prevent people from moving in the context of the war, of the independence war in the early 1920s, led by Mustafa Kemal. And he talks about these smuggling networks still in the early 1920s, people having to leave through these smuggling channels. So it suggests, at least to some degree, they are functioning even after the genocide.
Yeah, this is fascinating. And so you've been going around the United States now speaking about the book, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Which areas have you been to already? Or
so I gave a talk at Tufts that was sponsored by Nasser a few months ago in October, I believe. I was just at the Air Adiskigian Museum a couple of days ago. Of course, I'm speaking here at Fresno State today, March 10th. And as long as things don't get canceled, I'll be speaking in Irvine tomorrow, Wednesday, March 11th, and UCLA on March 12th, and then also at Columbia University on March 26th, and the University of Michigan on April 1st. Okay, again, we'll see how that all plays out, given the current situation with the virus. But
great. Thank you. My guest has been Dr. David Gutman from Manhattanville College. Thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Demirgardichian. During the breaks, we were listening to Armenian lullabies featuring the singing of Hasmik Haratunian with the Shogaken Ensemble, and she was singing a variety of Armenian traditional lullabies. Well, I want to give you an update on what's happening out at Fresno State and with the Armenian Studies program in light of what's happening with the virus situation. Fresno State is actually temporarily suspending in-person classes from Monday, March the 16th through Thursday, March the 19th. That's next week. To allow students, faculty to transition to virtual instruction. And that means that beginning on Friday, March the 20th, until about April 27th, all classes will be continuing at Fresno State, but will be offered online. So that's going to be a big difference for a lot of people. We'll be out at Fresno State, but we'll be preparing for this transition in our classes. And as far as our program, many, many events have also been affected by the virus. In fact, there's a whole list of events which have been canceled or postponed due to concern about the virus. And this is a evolving picture because as things change both locally and in the state and the country, things will change. And so I want to make sure to always give you an update about what's happening specifically with the Armenian Studies program. Our big event was scheduled for next Sunday, March the 22nd. That is the Armenian Studies program 32nd annual banquet. And I was really planning for that. It was going to be an outstanding event because actually we had a sellout already. And during the banquet, we were planning to honor the Leon S. Peters Foundation for their support of the Armenian Studies program, and also to recognize Dr. Arnold and Diane Gazarian also for their support of the Armenian Studies program. However, again, due to the situation with the virus and in an abundance of caution, we have decided to postpone that banquet, and we'll let all of our listeners know and our people that are coming to the banquet, we'll let you know when it will be rescheduled in order to allow us to have that banquet. The banquet is also really important because it's a time for our graduating seniors and those students who are getting their minor in Armenian studies to be able to be recognized. This year, we actually have 8 students who are graduating with a minor in Armenian studies, so we want to be able to give them the chance to be able to be recognized by the community. We also have various other events that are scheduled and on the schedule right now, including a Thursday, April the 2nd lecture by Dr. Ari Shakarian, who is our Kazan visiting professor in Armenian studies. And his talk is scheduled to be The Armenian Patriarchate, Politics and the Post-War Settlement in Istanbul, the story of Patriarch Zavin. That lecture is planned to be going on right now. So just make sure you check with our Facebook page, Armenian Studies Fresno State, or at our website, fresnostate.edu/Armenian Studies, to make sure you know about all of our upcoming events. So we'll try to keep you aware of all the things that are coming up. Of course, statewide, this has affected Armenian schools, private schools, and church schools. And in Armenian churches throughout the Western Diocese and Western Prelacy, Sunday school and Saturday schools have been canceled for the time being. But church services have been continuing. So it's, again, an evolving story that we're following. And, of course, the story is also to follow what is happening in Armenia with the virus situation, because this is something, again, that it's a small country of only about 3 million people. But already there have been 20 confirmed cases of coronavirus. And so this is now a new health issue in Armenia as well. And Armenia is bordering with Iran, where there has been a high number of people infected with the virus. So we are, you know, part of what's happening in the state and in the country. So we just have to be aware of all the things that are happening. And so we'd like to make sure that you stay updated with us about all of our upcoming events. Whether they're postponed or canceled, you will know because we will be posting it again on our website, at Facebook, or through our email connection that we also do. We'll be continuing with our shows and with All Things Armenian, and so this is something that we want to continue as well. So make sure that you keep tuned always to Multicultural 1600 AM to make sure that you're up to date with everything else. So for All Things Armenian, this is your host, Professor Barlow Dermagradichin, and we'll see you next week.
This was a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Este fue un programa pagado y solo refleja la opinión de sus anunciantes. Ahora continúa disfrutando de la programación de 1600 AM.